And our guest, Peter Ward, tonight. Where's the best place in the solar system to search for life? Let's find out in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Peter, the Japanese very shortly will be landing on an asteroid, and soon enough they'll be picking up some space dust and they'll bring it back to Earth for some analysis. Wouldn't that be interesting if some kind of life forms happen to be on that asteroid?
Well, we've got space dust coming at us a lot sooner than the Japanese mission. The project called Stardust, which picked up a piece of the comet Wild 5, is going to land in the Utah desert in January.
I didn't know that.
Yes, my friend Don Brownlee is the principal investigator of that.
Super.
This has been going on since 1999.
That's when it scooped it up?
Yeah, well, it scooped it up. Actually, it scooped it up the day before the landers landed on Mars this last time.
Okay.
And in all the excitement of the rovers, people sort of overlooked. This is a much more difficult mission. But the point I'm making about it, and I even discussed this in the book, is that there is no protocol for putting any of these samples in quarantine. Now,
good point.
We were bringing stuff back from space, and I don't believe in the Andromeda Strain movie so much, but nevertheless, you know, this could be a piece of one of those Pluto-sized bodies that broke up. It became an asteroid. You're scooping up who knows what sort of spores from space. And you remember the Apollo astronauts got stuck in quarantine for a while. Well, why not this space dust?
Now, why haven't they taken provisions for this?
Well, I don't know. You know, that's a great question. I don't know. It's coming down to Utah in your neighborhood soon.
I mean, because really, that's dangerous.
It's got the potential of being dangerous. We don't know if it is or it isn't, but it's kind of unknown. It's going to be very exciting.
Okay, somewhere in the solar system, we'll be searching for life. Where? How do we do it?
Boy, there's lots of places to go. I mean, the obvious is Mars, and that's got to be the best. If you're a better, you've got to bet either extinct life or living life. And again, it's not going to be animals. You know, when the Viking landers landed there in 75, Carl Sagan had them all fitted out with great big lights on top because he thought there were animals on Mars and you'd want to make sure that you could spot them at night. I mean, true story. Now we're hoping to find even microbes, but as we learn more and more about Mars, this seems like a better chance. You know, there's water there. We know that water or microbes live in the same sort of cold environments on Earth. Why not Mars?
Could they find there, Peter, worms or rodents or things that might live subsurface, perhaps, in little caves and tunnels?
Well, maybe, but I kind of doubt it. But for that sort of complex life, you need pretty complex ecosystems. And to have a complex ecosystem, you would have to have a very good sort of basic base of the food chain of plants. We've done enough roving on the surface of Mars to realize there's no plant life on the surface. There's no moss. There's nothing you can see. Even the small areas we've investigated, and believe me, those cameras from space can really pick out small stuff. That possibility is over. So now you're thinking subterranean. And Mars has such low atmospheric pressure and so little liquid water because it's so cold, it's really tough to imagine animal life, but it's really easy to imagine bacterial life.
What about Venus?
Venus is too hot. The only place you could find life on Venus, but it's still a possibility, is up in the clouds. And it would be really alien life, very cool alien life, because it would be acid-loving life. It would be a sulfuric acid-based type of life. I talk about this in the book as a very exciting possibility of the potential of sending a mission. A guy named David Grinspoon actually was the first to really think in detail about this, send a mission and scoop the clouds of Venus, bring it back, and check for life there.
That's interesting. Could you have, like, jellyfish life that flies in those clouds?
I don't think so. Again, the trouble with that is buoyancy, and you're going to be so far up that you have to be very light. Microbes can easily stay up. Whereas anytime you get even a little bit heavier, it falls out. So, again, unfortunately, it's microbial, but I still find that exciting.
Sure.
I don't know what's wrong with me.
Okay, Mercury too close to the sun,
no,
so that's no good.
No good on Mercury.
So we go the other way. Jupiter?
Nothing on Jupiter, but boy, the moon Europa, as you know, is a very exciting target. And there's a couple places it could be. First of all, the outer ice itself. We have life and ice on Earth. Why not there? Within the ice cover. But most hope is for the ocean itself. And you have an ocean 100 miles deep beneath, say, a mile thick of ice. 100 mile deep.
And this is ocean. Water?
It is water.
That's
it's water with ammonia in it, but it's water that's going to be a huge ocean. Huge ocean of water. And if you have water, why not life?
If on Europa, have they found what could be landmass, or is the whole thing water?
The whole thing's water. It's nothing but that Kevin Costner water world sent out into space.
Okay, now why would that be? Why would you have a planet of water and no land at all?
Yeah, great question. When the solar system formed, most of the heavier stuff came to the inner planets. And we have something called the snow line, and almost all the water went out into the outer part of the solar system, water and ammonia and methane and lots of light stuff. The heavy, rocky stuff went inward. The real question, not so much is why is there so much water out there, but why is there so much water on Earth? We've got an anomalously large amount of water, and most of that probably came from cometary impact early in Earth history. So those satellites have a little small rocky cores, the little bit of rocky stuff that was out there, and giant balls of water, which have a frozen outer rind and lots of liquid on the inside.
But Jupiter itself probably would harbor no life.
Yeah, I don't even think there's going to be a real surface on Jupiter. You just keep going down to the denser and denser gas. Jupiter's a big gaseous body. It's so different from a planet as we know it. The thing about Jupiter that breaks my heart, you remember, of course, the wonderful movie 2001.
Yes.
When that movie was made, they did not know that the greatest hazard to humans going to Jupiter was the fact that Jupiter emits such enormous radiation that no human could live in Jupiter orbit unless the spaceship was shielded so thickly with lead that it seems impossible. We don't think there could ever be a manned mission to Jupiter. The radiation just pervades
just too
system.
Much.
Totally unbelievable.
Robots.
Yeah, it would have to be robots. So, and the other deal, speaking of radiation, is that, you know, if we send anybody to Mars, the radiation hazard there is huge. NASA's already thinking about who to send to Mars, and it would have to be people beyond reproductive age.
That's a good point.
Middle-aged Martian scientists is the way it would be, because there would be a huge and very real danger of radiation poisoning and of problems with reproduction and birth defects later on down the road.
Well, all right, so let's move out to Saturn then. Anything there?
Oh, my favorite. Yours too, I bet. Titan. Yeah. Wasn't it exciting when down went Huygens?
Oh, loved it.
I was just, we were all cheering. We
asked oceans of methane, I think, or are they changing their mind on that?
No, it's still methane. Methane's a fabulous deal. And the reason I actually wrote my book is originally to be about Titan only. I got so excited about the possibilities of life on Titan, I just had to write a book about aliens, and pretty soon I filled in all the other stuff too. But Titan was what really got me charged up, and it's because you have there the possibility of great alien chemistry. It's the silicon carbon life we talked about earlier in the show. Titan is so cold that carbon life probably couldn't exist there. The chemical reactions would slow down to such a slow pace.
Mm-hmm.
You just couldn't have metabolism. But at very cold temperatures, these carbon-silicon bonds actually work. They start taking on the properties that carbon-carbon bonds do at warmer temperatures.
That's a good point.
So now we are looking at a real possibility of the most alien of aliens imaginable. And I'd love to hook up with one of your listeners, or maybe you, George. Somebody needs to do a screenplay about a manned mission to Titan and encountering these silent creatures.
That's a good idea.
Way beyond anything anybody's imagined.
I'm going to ask you in a moment what you think they could look like if they are there, but explain a little bit about the terrain to Titan. I'm a little confused about it, Peter. Whether it's all ice, when they say there's a sea of methane, what does that mean? Yet when I looked at the pictures, it clearly looked like a shoreline. So to me, it's almost as if this methane is in a liquefied form. So what does it all mean to Titan?
Well, it sure looked like a shoreline to me. You know, it looked like the California coastline, and then it looked like down in Mississippi in the Delta region down there when it started coming down. But I think that's really optical illusion. There is harder rock out there, because we've been able to see impact craters. But exactly how hard that rock is, whether it's true rock or whether it's just really frozen organic goo, is debatable. But some of the most fascinating images I think ever imagined come from a guy named Lorenz at Arizona. These guys, he wrote a book called Lifting Titan's Veil. And you can imagine being on Titan's surface, there's a very faint sun, so everything has sort of a ruddy glow because it's a very thick atmosphere. But you've got ice, but it's slushy ice, and it's frozen methane. You also have methane snow falling down, and you have the possibility of fumaroles, which are spitting up goo, and this could be either gasoline and ethane, or it's methane itself, again, jutting out as a geyser and then freezing when it hits the atmosphere and floating back down as snow.
You don't think it's an ocean of oil, do you?
Yes, I do. Not so much an ocean of oil, it's lakes of oil. Beneath that frozen surface, again, like Europa, there's going to be ammonia water down below. But all the petroleum needs of the world are sitting on Titan.
And it's abiotic then? It's not from fossil fuels?
Nope. This is just lots and lots and lots of organic goo.
You know what? You probably have demonstrated why we may have so much oil on this planet. We just haven't tapped into it.
Well, there may be a lot more than I hope there is. But boy, why doesn't Chevron go out there, get a pipeline?
Well, because they can keep the prices up, Peter.
Oh, I can't.
Well, that's another story all by itself. So Titan itself, then, if it harbors life, what are the possibilities then? What would it look like?
You know, nobody knows, because, again, the temperatures are so cold that the silanes that have been produced, we've produced them here in labs, have been so small that they have no visible, we've never had one big enough to be able for anybody to look at it. And microscopically, of course, light always acts very strangely. I'm not sure if it would reflect back like glass or being with carbon, if it would be a murky glass. That's a fascinating question we will know, because people are now building more and more bigger and bigger silanes, and we'll know soon. But boy, I can't even guess at the moment.
Well, if we did the script on Titan, the movie script, how would you have your characters, what would they look like?
You know, this is the hard part, because unless it's an animal, people just aren't going to care. It's really hard.
I agree. You know, that's earlier when I asked you the question, how exciting is it if you find a microorganism? And you said very exciting for science, but for most of us, even though it's dramatic, I'll give you that, for most of us, we want to see a creature. You know, we want to see a person. You want to see some being, something. And you're right. If it's not at least an animal or something like it, I think the public will be ho-hum about it.
I actually, just thinking about this, and this is probably wasting your time musing about this, but the way I would go about it is, I think about this, there's a very clever tiny microbe that comes together into a sphere called Volvox. It's a very primitive plant, and it has chloroplasts within it. These things are visible to the eye. When you break them apart, they just break apart in individual cells and go their merry way, but then they can reform again. So I would view these silanes then as being single-celled. You can't see them. And then being able to merge together into a much larger body. Microbes can do this. There are some macroscopic bacteria that do this. They bring together many cells. So let's build our silanes as huge spheres coming together on occasion and then disaggregating. So then you would have a 3D big enough form, and actually it makes some biological sense they would do this.
If they say there is no life outside of planet Earth in our solar system, maybe they come to this conclusion, what does that mean to us? Because one, that would be disappointing. Two, I can't believe it. But if that's the conclusion they come to, what does that mean?
Well, it sure means that every time we humans drive a species to extinction, that it's one more black mark against us.
Yeah.
If life is unique, we have no business claiming dominion over it.
Because of this solar system, you would expect some kind of life to be out there in this solar system.
I sure think so. Again, my bet's going to be on Mars.
Mars first.
But in my book, I advocate something that I've never seen before, which is a manned mission to Titan. And there's some reasons why.
You think that's possible?
Yeah, and actually there's something about Titan that makes it not only possible, but actually not that hard. The hardest part is overcoming the length of the voyage. How are you going to put some people in a very small ship for 7 to 10 years?
Oh, my God. And that's just one way?
Yeah, and have them not go crazy and kill each other.
They'll go nuts. They'll go insane.
If we can get around that problem, and that is the single biggest problem, there is something wonderful
and keep
about
them healthy.
Well, you know, right now I was at a couple of manned spaceflight conferences, and believe me, the problems of humans in space have not been solved. Human bodies don't do well in space. So this is not a non-trivial problem. Those who want to freeze people or put them to sleep, you know, that's a non-starter right now.
For 7 years, can you imagine that?
Yeah. So let's say we get them there. The good thing is that you got plenty of fuel when you get there for the return trip, but the best deal of all, you've got an atmosphere. You can parachute in. I mean, that's so great for spaceship missions. This is why Huygens was such a great success. They could parachute in. That's why the Mars missions are successful.
It'll be a bumpy ride down.
They can still parachute in. They got a thicker atmosphere than Earth does.
Well, once they parachute in, how are they going to get up?
Well, you got to build a rocket and blast your way off. But with all those hydrocarbons, you got enormous sources of energy there. I think our species sometime, certainly not on our lifetime, has to make that trip. We have to go to Titan just to answer that question. How alien can life be? And I think Titan can help us answer that question.
I would go to Mars in a heartbeat if they are looking for people.
Man, I would go be there right with you,
George. But I wouldn't go to Titan.
It'd be a hard trip, but just to see it, there's so many great things to be answered.
First of all, if you had any claustrophobia, that would be curtains for you. Well, can you imagine that?
7 years. 7 years. Humans have done it. You know, we've got people who've gone through longer in solitary confinement. But boy, to have a large mission. Yeah, that's just.
Every day would be the same.
It would be.
Over and over.
It would be. It would be. You'd have to have some very special people.
I don't think it could be done. I mean, you've brought up an interesting question. I do not think mankind can stay in a spaceship for 7 years and then you got to come back. What a depressing trip that would be.
Yep.
And you know what? I've always wanted to do a movie where the astronauts leave for maybe that length of time, but by the time they get back, something horrible has happened. There's no planet for them to return to, and they have to go find another one. And they've only got a certain window to be able to do that. And you know the name of the astronauts?
No.
Adam and Eve.
There we go. That would work for me.
That could be. How long did it take you to put the book together?
Well, there's kind of two answers to that. The actual writing wasn't that long. I actually spent about 7-8 months writing it. But you think about things, I guess when one writes, it's kind of I'm getting up there in age, and it's a long series of experiences and things I've seen and learned and done. And I finally just got to the point where stuff started coming out. I just saw a need for this, that there's been such nonsense about what aliens are and such nonsense by those who keep saying that there can't be aliens, that I thought a reasonable middle ground. Secondly, I tried to write the book for anybody who wants to read about life. It's not for scientists. I made all kinds of efforts to try to explain in non-jargon terms some really hard stuff in chemistry. And in some cases, I've succeeded, and some I've probably failed miserably. But I've tried to put together, at least without a chemistry degree, that you could see or just get a feel for what these alternative life forms might reasonably be. And reasonableness was my goal here.
Let's talk a little bit more about those viruses when we come back, because if you believe we might have been seeded by some viruses on this planet, who's to say we're still not getting pelted by viruses, diseases that we can't fight off? I'll also open up Fast Blasts. We'll take some of your Fast Blast questions for our guest, Peter Ward, right here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll open up Fast Blasts. We'll take your questions that way. And then next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, and you can chat with our guest, Professor Peter Ward, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Peter Ward. I'm George Norrie. We'll go to your Fast Blast questions in a moment. Peter, let's talk about the viruses for 1 second. If that is what seeded planet Earth, who's to say we're still not getting pelted by them? And, you know, maybe alien viruses could be, you know, maybe they were the AIDS virus or something. Is that possible?
Well, there's a lot of debate on, you know, we started thinking about panspermia, which is the idea that life could go from place to place. So what you would be talking about is Earth being the recipient of something via panspermia. I got a friend at Arizona who asked the question, if stuff is traveling through space, the best way to do it is send it on a rock. Free particles themselves, it would be very difficult for a virus, I think, to make its way to Earth's surface unless it were within a meteorite, let's say. It's pretty clear that meteorites can pass from planet to planet all through the solar system. Mm-hmm. But the analyses that have been done, and it's not that that many have been done, but the ballistic idea of sending a rock from a star to another star system, the probability is really low. It's really low that you would make your way to another star system and not go in between stars, and lower yet, you would land on a planet. So within a solar system, yes, but between solar systems, probably not. But that said, I do believe that the origin of life scenario does pass through viruses, or that they evolve very quickly. And again, within rocks, you could pack a lot of viruses, and you certainly, every time a big asteroid hits a planet, it throws stuff up. You know, the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs, bits and pieces of that are all over the moon. All we have to do is go up there and collect them.
Isn't that something? You're right. I mean, it did. When it hit this planet, it blew off and it went that far, maybe even farther.
Oh, way, way farther. There's pieces of it on Mars. There's plenty of it on Venus. So stuff does travel. Whether or not viruses are falling on the planet now, there's certainly a lot of particles called IDPs, interplanetary dust particles, that are falling onto the Earth by the ton load every day. And within that, how much is biological? And that's a great question.
John from San Gabriel in California wants to know, how is it that hydrocarbons can form without life? How is that possible?
Well, you can make hydrocarbons. It was certainly the way that it worked on Earth. I mean, most of the reduced carbon that happened upon Earth was mediated by life itself, but organic compounds such as methane, and you can get even longer chains than methane, carbon with lots of hydrogen, forms in space. You know, we see lots of cases where this stuff can occur inorganically. Ethane is a very short organic molecule. We call it organic because it's the carbon hydrogen that we use in our body, but it's made not by organic processes.
All right, next up, let's go to another Fast Blast question here for you, Peter. Computer's a little small because a lot of people are trying to get in. Meteors. And again, well, you basically answered that when you were talking about the delivering of such. But how is it that these viruses formed on these meteors in the first place?
Yeah, great, great question. I don't think they did. I think the viruses themselves form on a place like our early Earth that had water. I think you really do need to have a very sort of benevolent cradle for life. And then once you make it, you could be really mean and send it anywhere you want. But, I mean, the listener has that's a really good point. I don't think, for instance, you could build life in outer space. I don't think you could build it in most places. I think it's a very small, select few places that allows the formation of life.
Well, Peter, if you take this group of scientists, and all of them believe that there is some kind of intelligent life out there somewhere, did you folks try to theorize on whereabouts it might be out there?
No, again, the committee was mostly worried about the chemistry of life, and most people are concentrating so much on life of the small. I mean, it's kind of sad that people aren't putting that much effort. We leave that to SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. That's really the best and most efficient way for figuring out if there is other intelligence that at least is trying to talk to us. And there's just so much hard work for even figuring out how the simple stuff works. You know, I can't even figure out how a sponge works, let alone a bacteria. I can't imagine trying to work on intelligent stuff.
Some people want to know if they can email you. Do you have a business type email address?
Oh, yeah, easily emailable. I name myself after the great boat builder, Argo, A-R-G-O, at u.washington.edu. So I can also be found in the University of Washington Faculty Directory, Peter Ward. I'm in three departments.
The book is not too complicated for people to read. It's important that everyone knows that.
I hope not. This is my 13th, 14th attempt at trade science writing, and I'm finally figuring out what you can say, what you can't say, although it's dealing with chemistry is one of the hardest things. I've generally written about, otherwise about astrobiology, but a lot of paleontology, and simple life is hard to write about.
I'm going to paraphrase Lonnie's message here from Las Vegas. Wants to know if you put God into any of your equations.
You know, there's certainly God in my life, but that part of my life is absolutely, totally separated and walled off. So God's on Sundays, and I work the rest of the week, so they don't mix.
Bill from Miami, Florida, says, do we take any precautions not to infect life on another planet with our viruses?
Oh, boy, that's such a great question, such a great thought by the listener, and we're not taking enough precautions. We have certainly infected Mars. We've certainly infected Venus, but that's been sterilized. We're going to infect the moons of Jupiter. We've already landed microbes on Titan. We have done a terrible, terrible job of reverse contamination.
How have we infected Mars, for example?
There's no way you could build a sterile spacecraft. And I guarantee that every spacecraft that has ever crashed on Mars has been carrying viable bacteria.
And why don't they die en route?
They can survive space. They can just go into a nice spore stage. And a lot of bacteria live in Antarctica, for instance, in the most hostile conditions. So they just go very quiet. You know, people are now taking bacteria out of permafrost. And in some cases, the permafrost they're getting it out of is over 1 million years old. And they have perfectly happy bacteria coming back to life.
Interesting question from Bruce in Phoenix. If you fire combustion rockets in Titan's atmosphere, which a lot of it's all methane, would that ignite the atmosphere?
Well, that's a great question, but it wouldn't, because you need oxygen to light gasoline, and there's no oxygen in it. So you're home free.
So that will not occur. We don't have to worry about that.
Great question, though.
You've proposed a new place where life may have first evolved in Earth. Specifically, where might that have been?
Yeah, that's a good thought, and I thought long and hard about this, and a friend of mine, again at Caltech, Jill Kirschfink, has suggested this. It's not my original idea. I've tried to expand upon it. Linked impact craters. And there's a funny story here, if I may. It was often thought, gee, how in the world would you ever build life on the early Earth? And some wag said, well, if you had a trained organic chemist with all the chemistry sets, you might have a chance at it. So we started thinking, gee, where would you get chemistry sets? And the new idea is that the way to get ribose, which is the chemical, the sugar that you need to build RNA, which takes you to DNA, is through borate minerals. And the reason the Death Valley days was set and the commercials were for borax soap was that borate minerals come from deserts. But you need a chemistry set. So where do you get a desert with a chemistry set? And the answer is linked impact craters. If you had asteroid impact craters on a slope, one above the other, groundwater would percolate through one, percolate through another. You have a way of decanting liquid in the same way a series of test tubes would. So this is the idea, is that you have a whole series of impact craters. They get wet, the borax dissolves, they dry, you synthesize a little sugar, they get wet, they dry, and some goes down to the groundwater, it goes to the next, or it gets more concentrated, down through the groundwater to another, and sooner or later, you get life. So this is the new idea.
That's interesting. And you might be able to do that throughout the universe.
Yep. You got to have deserts. You've got to have water coming and going. And you've got to have a way of having chemistry sets. And impact craters will do that. So that's a chapter in the book.
Sounds like Mars.
Sure does, doesn't it? Funny you should say that. I had the same idea.
Well, that would be something. Somebody wants to know if you know about probiotics. I've never heard that phrase before. We've talked about abiotics. What about probiotics?
Don't know what it is.
Neither do I.
I apologize.
So we will move on that one. You know, as this evolved, what's next in terms of trying to find life? You know, we've got the rovers. They're still miraculously working on Mars. You know, the Japanese, we just mentioned what they're going to do. You just mentioned what's going to happen in January here. That's exciting. You know, what's next out there, Peter?
Well, some of the best stuff that's going on is coming, again, out of the NASA Astrobiology Institute. It's just such a tiny fraction of NASA's budget. I just hope it doesn't get eaten up.
Well, they're talking about chopping up stuff. That might be in it.
Well, the astrobiology budget already lost $10 million this year, so it's a small budget, and it's very spooky. But there's a group at Carnegie. There's a genius named Andrew Steele, and Steele is amazing. He is an instrument builder, so he is building instruments of very small size that hopefully can detect life. And much of the genius of our species now is going into building better machines that satellites, robots can take to see if life is there or not. I mean, that's a really hard thing to do is, for instance, even now, send some instrument to Antarctica and tell us whether there's life there or not. We couldn't do it at the moment, on Earth.
That's true. Don't you think the rovers that have been so successful should have had the capability of looking for life?
Well, that was our hope, but, you know, one step at a time. They really had to, we had so many of those failures. Remember, cheaper, faster, crashed better, quicker. Well, we had to
Or we forgot to go from
joules. We had to show that it could be done. The next generations are going to get closer and closer, but it's just not fast enough for me, you know? I'm getting old too fast. I want to see this stuff happen now.
How'd you like to be the guy who forgot to make the conversion on that one?
Oh, there's a lot of people I don't want to be, but he'd be high on my list. I've made blunders in my life, but maybe not that many that public.
Is that a fireable offense? Do you think they got him, poor guy?
You know, I wonder, in our own state, we had a huge $300 million floating bridge across Lake Washington, and one day, 10 years ago, some guy forgot to close the stopcock, and the $300 million bridge sank that afternoon.
The whole thing?
The whole thing. Great accident in Seattle. Floating bridge sank. So I wonder if that guy gets fired.
Did they ever rebuild it?
Oh, yeah. Cost a lot more to rebuild. We now have two spans where the original sunk.
And where are the pieces? Are they still down there?
Oh, yeah. It's concrete floating bridge.
Probiotics, beneficial bacteria that aid in digestion found in yogurt.
There we go.
Very good. Thanks.
Learned something good?
Well, all right.
I still can't say anything about it.
Clint from Culver City, California. What do you think about aliens creating a special creature capable of handling space travel, carrying out missions in space? Maybe that's who's visiting our planet. Well, we call them robots, don't we?
Yeah, and it's funny you say that because, I was at a couple of these conferences about humans in space, which themselves are both depressing and fascinating. But one of the topics brought up in a similar vein is that should we genetically engineer the next generation of astronauts? Could we produce people that would have characteristics that could better withstand the physical and psychological aspects? And so we're getting close to building some very strange humans, but it may end up as that.
A question I always ask real scientists, do you believe we've been visited by aliens, not just the bacterial or virus type, but the intelligent type?
Personally, if you want my opinion, I think no.
Okay.
And the reason I say no is anything curious enough to build stuff, I don't think would visit without leaving a calling card.
You never know.
Well, that's true.
Again, how can an organism from a meteor survive the heat? You know, this is it. I didn't ask you this. Survive the heat of entry. This is from Alex, who is out there, way out there in Eastern Europe listening.
Yeah, Alex, that's a great question. And it was answered, actually, by a European colleague of yours. The European Space Agency was asking the same question as were colleagues of mine at Caltech. But what they did is on one of the Mir trips, and they actually had a couple of the Russian space capsules, the Russians let them paste on some rocks that had bacteria stuck in them. And while the surface of the rocks burned, the bacteria, just a couple centimeters down, survived the trip. And so they have living bacteria after coming down. Rocks turn out to be really good at withstanding heat. And so soon after the Martian meteorite came to Earth, that was the question everybody asked, and it was solved to everybody's satisfaction. Even a small rock from space, if you go deep enough, is a good heat shield.
We didn't talk too much about our closest neighbor, the moon. What do you think's on the moon, Peter?
The coolest thing that's on the moon are fossils. There was a group of
fossils?
University of Washington that came up with a really clever analysis. We've been talking about asteroids hitting the planet. The problem with the Earth and understanding the origin of life is that there's really no good old rock left on Earth that hasn't been smooshed and smashed by plate tectonics, metamorphism. You know, the oldest rocks we know of are in Greenland, and they're really metamorphosed. And yet, the early bombardment was a period from 4.2 to 3.8 billion years ago when the Earth got smacked. Look at the moon, and you can see the Earth was of the same messy, crater-strewn place. Now, an awful lot of that rock that was on the Earth with those gigantic asteroid impacts landed on the moon. We know this.
Well, don't you think the moon was chipped off the planet? Some people think that.
Yeah, the moon certainly resulted from the Earth mashing into a Mars-sized object, but we think some of the oldest fossils of Earth itself are in rocks found on the moon now. We're proposing a mission to the moon simply to look for Earth fossils on the moon.
Okay. You know, you brought up something that I've always believed in, and science has agreed now, too. This planet collided with another huge object a long time ago. Where did that object go?
The object became us. There's some fascinating computer illustrations of how that happened, how the moon formed. You have these two very large bodies. They merge into each other. They do this dance. They pull apart. Lots of stuff orbits around them. They merge into each other. They pull apart. They merge in. They pull apart. And the moon flies off, goes into orbit. There's been a couple of really good computer animations of how this happens. It's on the web someplace.
And were these solid planets at the time, us and the one that collided with us?
Yeah, newly coalesced. I mean, they certainly weren't solid to the point of differentiated into crust, mantle, and core, but they were large bodies, smaller than the Earth is now, because it was smaller than Earth and a body the size of Mars. The two merging together produce Earth and the moon. So you have the two smaller planets, but the added masses together, again, equal Earth plus moon.
Interesting. And who's to say then what that other planet brought to the table?
Yep. Great question.
Maybe it brought the water.
Well, one wonders if that collision had not happened, if we don't have a moon, do you and I have this conversation? Is the moon necessary for the evolution of advanced life on the planet? And some people think so.
That could be. And when do you think this collision occurred?
4.6 billion years ago.
So right at the beginning?
Right at the beginning, yeah. It's just after the Earth coalesced. It's very soon, right after the start of things.
Had the collision not occurred, and again, let's say we didn't have the moon then, what might have become of this other object? Would that have ended up in the solar system somewhere?
Sooner or later, I think that collision would have taken place. If you've got two bodies orbiting at about, they were probably independently formed in the coalescence of the solar nebula that became our solar system.
Sure.
There are big areas called feeding zones. It's kind of like where you take a snowball and run it through. If that collision hadn't happened, is the Earth in the same form and shape that it is now? Who knows?
When we come back, Peter, I want to ask you how we know there was a collision in the first place with another object, and we'll open up the phone lines. I'm George Norrie. One more hour to go with our guest, Peter Ward, right here on Coast to Coast AM.